We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
You're listening to From the Chair, and I'm your host, Mike Hamilton. Join us each episode as we talk to athletic directors from across America. We're going to talk about topics like leadership, career development, issues of the day, and I can promise you we're going to have some fun along the way, too. So sit back, listen in, and let's dive in. Let's go.
Hey, welcome in. Today's episode is with Syracuse Director of Athletics, John Wildhack. John, thanks for being with me.
Mike, my pleasure. Great to be with you. I like the intro music, Mike. Did you pick that? You know, a little jazz track there? I like that.
I suggested that I wanted a little bit more, you know, jazz type vibe. So that's what we came in with. And that's where we're rolling right now. You know, may have to adjust it at some point, maybe a little bit more rock interest. But for now, you caught up on it. It's jazz for sure, man. One of my favorite genres of music. So hey, I appreciate jumping on here for a few minutes today. And these have been interesting over the last several months to talk to your colleagues, my colleagues, about different issues in athletics. And, you know, as you might imagine, every single one of them has been different for different reasons. And I've talked to you a little bit in advance about kind of what I wanted to hit on here. And I think it'll be interesting for our listeners. And the first thing I want to talk about is just simply the fact that, you know, you're at Syracuse, it's your alma mater. There are a few, obviously, a number of folks around the country who serve at their alma maters. And I think it's an interesting proposition, an interesting thing to talk about just for a minute. I've often thought about the fact that, you know, you obviously understand the university. You went there. You were, you're from the area, the New York area. And at the same time, while you know your job from the perspective of being an alum, you're also in the sausage factory, right? And when you're a Syracuse fan or Wake Forest fan or wherever you're talking about, sometimes as an alum, it's kind of better to be on the outside of the sausage factory. But you're in the sausage factory. I'm curious as to where do you feel like being an alum of Syracuse University has been most helpful to you? And then also maybe some places along the way where you maybe parked the car on the side of the curb and said, man, I wish I could view this for a third party for just a moment to help me get through this. If you don't mind, I'd like to hear from you on this.
Mike, I think where it helped me the most is just knowing people, right? And knowing fellow alums and having relationships with fellow alums. And I had stayed connected with the university after I graduated through the Newhouse School, through the Falk School of Sport Management, obviously through athletics with people that I knew from my time at ESPN. So the knowledge of the people, the knowledge of the institution, staying close to the place, all were advantages to, I think, in terms of, you know, my, my acclimation here. I think probably, you know, what's hardest is, you know, you take your fandom, right? And you take that fandom and you put it aside. I mean, obviously I'm still a fan, but it's a totally different lens. It's a totally different perspective. And, you know, at some point, you know, when they throw me out of here, you know, I'll go back to being a huge fan again.
You know, I probably know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You obviously were a senior executive at ESPN for a number of years, very successful career there, and you're offered the opportunity to come back to your alma mater. Would you have done this anywhere else?
No, I wouldn't have. And it was in that, and I've got tremendous respect for so many schools and institutions around the country, but there's only one place I would have done this for. And Syracuse is pretty special to me and our family. My dad went here, did his undergrad. In the World War II years, my oldest sister went here, my older brother, my two nephews are recent graduates. Obviously, I went here, so it's been a huge part of our family. My high school senior just got accepted last month, early decision to Syracuse, and that's probably the happiest I've ever seen him in his life. So it's a place that's, you know, it's real special to my family. And for me, what it did is my experience at Syracuse gave me the foundation from the Newhouse School of Communications to go to ESPN and to really launch my career. And for that, I'm forever indebted.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, so there are a lot of younger listeners to this podcast in the industry, and thinking about you heading to ESPN right out of your college experience, which would have been in the early 80s, if I remember correctly.
Right.
Those were, yes, it's probably interesting, your perspective on the evolution of ESPN, and maybe share for a minute sort of what the setting looked like from a network perspective when you joined the network right out of college. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the evolution of the network, and in particular, your role in some of that as we move through the next few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, basically, when I started at ESPN, the network had been on there like 13 months. It was a startup, Mike. That's what it was. And nobody really knew if it was going to make it or not financially. The idea of a 24-hour sports network seemed totally absurd at the time and was rejected by the experts. Most of us were young, pretty much fresh out of school. So, you know, we're like, hey, you know, we're working in sports, which we love. We're getting paid very little, and an emphasis, full caps on very little, bold, underline. But we're like, hey, if this thing works, great. If not, all right, we'll get a real job someplace. And, it was really the diversified services of Getty Oil, that division, because Getty Oil owned ESPN at the time. And they're the ones who really stomached the losses in the early days of ESPN when they could have shut the doors down and they didn't.
John, during your, no, so now you're doing your 30 years. You won 30 Emmys, you and your colleagues together, and the number of things that you've been a part of. I mean, someday I just want to sit down offline and over, you know, a drink or a cup of coffee and talk more about that, because I just think it's so intriguing. In fact, you ought to write a book. But one of the things that I picked up on, it's kind of wild to think about this. You produced the first live college football game for ESPN. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mike.
So in 1984, and for me, that didn't seem very, very far, you know, very long ago. I know that those years are going farther apart as we move down the road. But what did that look like, producing the first live college football game for ESPN? You know, that had to be an incredible thing.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was great. It was, you know, it was an honor to do it. And the game was Pitt at BYU. Ironically, that was the year that BYU won the national championship. And they went into Pitt, and, you know, Pitt was, you know, I think preseason top 10 and absolutely loaded. And BYU went in and stunned them and upset them. And it was just, I think that game, you know, was one of the things that live college football, not that game, but live college football helped put ESPN on the map and give ESPN credibility with distributors and advertisers. So to have the opportunity to do that first game was, you know, for me is a career highlight. And it's something I always remember. But when I look back on it, what's ironic is that was the year that BYU won the national championship. Robbie Bosco was their quarterback. And yeah, I remember it more for that, frankly, than it was the first, you know, live game on ESPN.
Yeah. For context, where was ESPN's broadcasting of college basketball at that time?
At that time, we were doing a lot of live college basketball, but, you know, and again, that'd give us credibility. We were doing the early rounds of the tournament. The early rounds of the men's NCAA tournament is what really, that was the first dose of credibility. But then there are additional doses that were needed to really, all right, this thing is going to work. It's going to last. It's going to survive. It's going to succeed. It's going to accelerate distribution. It's going to grow the ad sales. It's going to lead to larger rights deals and more expansive rights deals. You know, ultimately, you know, the NFL, MLB, et cetera, that type of thing. Live college football was absolutely critical to not only the success, but I think the survival of ESPN. I think if we didn't have that package, I'm not sure we would have survived.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm interested in your perspective on the times, you know, since that time, obviously, in terms of the change in production, the quality of the production, camera angles, whatever. You're now sitting here as an athletic director, and I know you've got to be concerned about how games are produced, and because it's your brand, right? It's your brand in the marketplace, the Syracuse sure. brand, the ACC brand, that kind of thing. Are there things that you can point to that you feel like are seminal moments in terms of the evolution of production that have now made college football? Let's talk about college football for just a minute. The production that it is. I mean, you know, now we now have, like, in the CFP, there are multiple, you know, I can't remember what's called, megacast or whatever, right? Multiple
megacast, exactly.
Yeah, verse so many versions of the actual broadcast, et cetera. What are the things that you feel like have been markers over these last 30 plus years of things in the evolution of production that have meant more to the fans and also to the university?
Yeah, it's number one, sports has always been a driver of innovation in all of media. It's always been that way. And I think part of that is because of the competition that we all have. And whether it's ESPN, CBS, NBC, Fox, you name it, you know, Turner, you know, we all want our product to be the best. And I think that really, you know, we embrace technology early on. And we saw that with technology, we could do a lot of different things. And you know, it was kind of a base feed to begin with. And then as technology evolved, I mean, you know, the lenses got more powerful, super slow motion in the mid 80s came to the market. And we purposely put our super slow mo cameras, you know, kind of field level on our biggest lenses, you know, because it would give us some dramatic replays that, you know, heretofore you couldn't see. I think the other thing was just the enhancements in audio. And I think that's often underrated because, yes, it's a visual medium, but imagine watching a game where there's no audio, there's no NAT sound, right? You know, you don't hear the band, you don't hear the quarterback, you know, barking signals, that type of thing, and it continued to evolve, and you know, graphics and the ability in the graphics devices and machines and what they could generate. And animation, and that you could animate in real time. You could animate on the fly, replay technology. So it's been incredible to see it. And it went from kind of, you know, all right, here's one linear telecast, which became increasingly sophisticated, to all right, now for the big events, how do you do the megacast concept, right? And all right, now you can use all the platforms that you have because you've got more methods to distribute the content. So you can do that. And you see that done with NFL playoff games, what CBS has done with Nickelodeon. I was part of ESPN is we televised Super Bowl 50 on ESPN Deportes. That was really pretty cool, you know, to do that. And I think it was CBS who had the rights to the game, but they had no Spanish outlet. And I went to the NFL, I'm like, this is crazy. So, all right. So we produced, Spanish language telecast for Super Bowl 50. So now with technology, has to be our ally, and it has to be our ally in the industry. It has to be our ally for college sports. And you just see the sophistication. You see the NCAA men's basketball tournament, and how that, with the multi-platform perspective there. College football, just again, games are on ESPN, ESPN2, ACC Network, SEC Network, Fox, Big Ten Network, Fox, Big Fox, FS1, FS2. So it's the platforms have grown, and as media companies have grown and developed more platforms, college football has been a natural to populate those platforms. And it's all because of one reason, Mike. It's because the popularity of college football. To me, a real seminal moment in the growth of college football. ABC used to do kind of the 3:30 window, right? And there'd be a kind of a four-way regional, right? So there'd be four games at 3:30, and the West Coast would get this game, and the Midwest would get this game, the Southeast would get this, the Northeast would get that game. And this is when we were at ESPN, and I give a tremendous amount of credit to Dave Brown, who, in my opinion, is the greatest scheduler in the history of college football. And I went to Brownie and I said, how can we do this differently and populate these games across not ABC, but move some of these games to ESPN so that we get away from the four-way regional? What that led to is every game ultimately being delivered and available nationally. And I think that grew the popularity of college football and turned it into what was really almost more of a regional sport into a national sport. And now it's the second most popular sport in this country. And I think a key driver of that is when we looked at the model and said, you know what, there's a better model to distribute games and televise games. And this is a national sport. This isn't a regional sport. This sport is so compelling that the right game, people will watch on it regardless geographically where they live.
Great background, great history. The evolution's been nothing short of phenomenal. So let's talk about the next steps, right? There was an article in the New York Times within the last couple of days about cable viewership, cable subscriptions, stagnant or on the decline. My kids, this, my children range in age from 25 to 13. I can't get them to sit down to watch an entire live game anymore. They will still watch live college athletics, but it's in pieces typically. I do think most people, when they have their satellite subscription or their cable subscription, largely it centers around this idea of live college athletics. I don't know what the title is, John. Is it micro content, fourth tier content, whatever? I'm interested in your perspective as one who's been in the industry and around that for so long. What is the next phase of this? Is it smaller bites of the competition, but still having, obviously, the competition is still going to play out, right? How are we going to be viewing college athletics in the next 5 and 10 years?
Well, I think what you see now is a proliferation of streaming services, right? And every media company has a streaming complement. And at some point, and I'm not sure when that is, and I don't, in my opinion, it's not imminent, but eventually there'll be a tipping point where the streaming model and streaming is going to be more lucrative to the media companies than the cable bundles we know it now. And when that happens, they want to be prepared to have the streaming services. Along with that, in at ESPN, we did this is when we introduced ESPN Mobile. And first was ESPN the phone, which was a dramatic failure. Because we realized we can't be in the hardware business. We can't we can't compete with Verizon. But what we could create is to your point, the snackable content, right? We could turn around highlights and distribute highlights and deliver them to a mobile device. And we could turn highlights around within 30 seconds. So maybe I don't want to watch the entire game, but I'm interested in this game. Is okay, I can go on my mobile device, right? I can set a preference for what games, what teams I want to follow, and my feed is automatically populated with highlights from that game. So I'm not watching that game on a real-time basis, but I'm getting the highlights as they occur on a near real-time basis. So that's another way that I can follow it. And I just think there'll be a continuation of that snackable content they'll still, you know, the games are still going to be televised in their entirety because they need to be. And by the way, the time spent viewing, there's still a decent percentage of the audience that will watch the majority of the game. Time spent viewing for sports exceeds that of any form of entertainment content by far. But it'll be almost like a menu, right, that you get to choose from. And it's all right, well, if I want to watch the live game, well, all right, maybe I'm still a cable subscriber, I'm a satellite subscriber. All right, maybe I subscribe to Hulu, right? Maybe I'm a YouTube TV, maybe I'm a streaming service provider. But maybe with my mobile device, what I am is, all right, you know, I assign who are my favorites are, and I'm going to get that snackable content, and I'm going to get a lot of it over the course of that game. And I may, you know, we used to do at ESPN, we put out, you know, 35, 40 highlights in the course of a game.
Yeah. Let's switch back to Syracuse more specifically for a few minutes. You know, I know from our conversations and visits to your area.
I'll turn my lights back on for you, Mike.
There's been a lot of work done the last couple of years on an iconic structure, the Dome. And, you know, we all know Syracuse by the Dome, right? And served the university so well for so long now, both football and basketball, lacrosse, so many other events. I think maybe you shared with me it's upwards of 250, 270 events, or maybe more per year.
Right.
Talk about the importance of what you've done there in the last couple of years with a sort of, let's call it the restructure of that building and the new roof and so forth, and why that's important for your athletic program.
Well, it's just, to me, it's the centerpiece of Syracuse athletics. It's the centerpiece of the Central New York region. It's really a community asset, a community treasure. It's a point of pride for people. It is, I think it's the most unique facility in all college sports. And as you said, five sports call it home, football, both basketball programs, both lacrosse programs. You know, what we did is really the new construction with it is, you know, the roof is kind of the headliner per se, but we did so much more. You know, it was kind of a top-down approach, right? You do the roof, now you do the lighting. So we brought Musco in, and our lighting now is absolutely state-of-the-art, as sophisticated as any building in the country, right? You do your sound. We totally redid our sound system. Center hung scoreboard, which is the largest in college sports by far. It's the fourth largest in the country. So all of that, and our end zone video boards, all that, and by the way, the video boards, they're all like 8K resolution. It's unbelievable, the resolution. And it all translates into a much better fan experience. And when people walk in there now, the play, it pops, it's vibrant, and our fans love it. And part of what we need to do in college sports, we need to upgrade the fan experience across the board. We need to give the fans something they can't replicate by sitting at home and watching, right, on television or getting their snackable content on their mobile device. So, you know, that's kind of the basics of what we've done. There's still a lot more that we want to do. And we've got a long list of menu items. So we're not done yet. We redid our concession stands. We went to a totally touchless model with concessions. Our fans love it. It's quicker. It's a quicker transaction for the fan. They miss less game time. So everything is predicated on how do we enhance the fan experience.
That's great. So, a guy who's won a lot of games in that building, I'm intrigued. I am intrigued by the concept of leadership. What makes leaders tick? How are they successful? What forms their success? I don't believe there's a specific formula for everyone's success. But you've got a guy there who, as I said, has won a lot of games, Coach Bayon, in that building. And I know you've known him for a long time, and he's been extremely successful. Now that you work with him on a daily basis as his colleague and boss, what makes Coach Boeheim so successful?
It's a great question, and there'll never be another one like him, right? That's going to stay at, you know, one place for as long as he has. I just think Jim is just, he's incredibly focused. He's incredibly knowledgeable. He's incredibly passionate about the sport. You know, everybody thinks, oh, it's always the 2-3 zone, but Jim's curious, and that zone will evolve, and it continues to evolve, and he'll tweak it even in game. I think one of his great strengths is is once the ball goes up, I think he's one of the great in-game coaches ever. Dave Gavitt told me that when he was alive. And in my mind, there's no, you know, one of the most brilliant basketball minds ever was Dave Gavitt. And Jim is just at the same time, he's able, he's competitive as anybody, right? And that comes through at the same time as he never lets the highs get too high or the lows get too low. He's incredibly supportive as of assistant coaches. He delegates a tremendous amount to his assistant coaches. He's always been just a tenacious recruiter, you know, and he understands, you know, you can be the greatest coach, you can have the greatest system in the world. You need great players. You need really good players. And it's a model of consistency that, again, I'm not sure it'll ever be equaled again.
Yeah, you hope when some of these iconic and legendary coaches come along, we all, fans, both to the specific institutions, but in general, pause to take a moment. And, you know, you can get mad at a certain loss or whatever, right? But at the end of the day, these are really special folks. You know, I had the chance to work with Coach Summit at Tennessee, and I felt like I tried to take a deep breath every now and then and realize who I was working alongside, right? And try to glean from her what made her so successful. And it's not to say that there won't be another highly successful women's basketball coach at University of Tennessee or another highly successful men's basketball coach at Syracuse. But these are special times that you hope that fans and us, that we pause for a moment and sort of soak that in, right? It's an important
thing. Yeah, you treasure and you be thankful for what you have. And you're right, there'll never be another Pat Summit. There won't be.
Yeah.
There'll never be a Jim Boeheim. And, you know, you're just, you know, it's – I'm fortunate to work with him. He's been great to work with, by the way. He's been great. He's helped me. You know, we've shared ideas. We've exchanged ideas. He's been incredibly supportive of what I've tried to accomplish here. And you're right. You know, treasures like this, it doesn't come along very often. And when they're part of your life and part of your university and part of your community, embrace that and be thankful for that, because it's a rarity.
So I think I mentioned to you, I recently read Dan O'Neill's book, The Big East, and it's an incredible history of the league. It reminds you so much of, you know, that the evolution of that league. But, you know, you guys at ESPN played a big role in that, by the way, as you know, and Syracuse played a big role in the evolution of that league. And certainly you're in a great league now, the Atlantic Coast Conference. And you're actually going to play some of your former competitors from the Big East in the ACC. I'm curious, and I'm ashamed I don't know the answer to this, by the way, but do you still have some rivalry games occasionally with some of your former Big East schools like Georgetown and UConn, or has that sort of gone by the wayside at this point?
Georgetown we play every year.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's awesome. You know, that's the one that's consistent, because that's, you know, frankly, that was, you know, that was the rivalry. Georgetown Syracuse made the Big East.
That's right.
You know, it was Patrick Ewing and Pearl Washington. It was John Thompson and Jim Boeheim, and no disrespect to anybody else, because every, you know, so many other schools and coaches and players played a role. But what really launched the Big East, you know, that was the rivalry. And for a period of time, that was, I would argue, that was the most intense rivalry in college basketball. I mean, it was intense. Those games were crazy. But it was a lot of fun. So yeah, we play them every year, and I think we should play them every year. And our fans want to. We've got a great alumni base in D.C. So when we go down there, it's great for our fans in the D.C. area. We love having them come up in the Dome. Tremendous respect for that program. It's great to see Patrick coach now. You know, we competed for 4 years against him and just had some epic battles. He got the most of us the majority of the time, but not all the time. And now that he's back and we compete against him, but as a head coach, that's pretty cool.
Well, look, I apologize for not knowing that you were playing every year. I'm embarrassed by that. But it's clear that was a critical piece of that whole conference narrative. And the book, by the way, if you haven't read it, that Dana wrote is phenomenal for those who are students of history and love sports. So it's really,
great
really
book.
Good.
It's a great read. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me just a couple things and we'll wrap up here. Contemporaneous issues for just a moment. We've lived through a lot in the last 24 months. It's hard to believe it's now been almost 24 months with the pandemic, right? And I heard the dean of Emory Medical this morning on something I looked at, you know, sort of speculating on what these next couple months look like. And really he was hitting on the fact that he believes that we have learned a lot in the last 24 months and that we've learned so much that it can inform how we navigate these next 6 to 8 to 12 weeks. And that hopefully that should not lead to, let's call it a macro shutdown. We should be able to navigate through that. And so I'm curious from your chair, as it relates to the college athletics environment, and now we're in the throes of basketball season, and we've seen a number of cancellations across the country. What have you learned in the last 24 months that help you navigate these, let's hope, these next few weeks as we come out of winter and hopefully move on to what we will be a new phase of life post-pandemic at some point?
Well, I think, it's challenged all of us in ways that, I think we never imagined. And every once in a while, I used to joke, and it was, maybe a little gallows humor, but I'd go to my assistant, Mary Kelly. I'm like, Mary, go through the files. There's got to be that, there's got to be that manual from the 1918 pandemic. There has to be a template here. And yeah. and of course, so I think the first thing is when that hit is, all right, I asked the question myself, what's most important? Most important is the health and the safety of our young men, our young women, and our staff. Okay. So what can we do? How do we partner with the university? How do we partner with public health experts to do that, to keep people as safe as possible? Secondly, how do we communicate? And communicate frequently with student athletes, our staff, parents of student athletes, which I think was critical because I wanted the parents of our student athletes to have confidence in Syracuse University and Syracuse Athletics that we were doing everything we can to keep their daughter or their son safe. And then ultimately, as we transition into the testing phase, and I credit the ACC and the ACC's Medical Advisory Group and John Swofford for putting that together, and Dr. Cameron Wolf, who's a infectious disease expert at Duke, is our chair. He's been phenomenal. That established baselines for all 15 schools to follow. All right, then we had the introduction of the vaccines. It was educating our student athletes and their families, their parents, and our staff. And all right, here's why you need to get vaccinated. You do it to protect yourself. You do it to protect your loved ones. Now we have, the boosters, et cetera, that type of thing. We've reinvented, right? Everybody had to reinvent how they, what they do with practice. We all worked with pods back in the summer, in the fall of 2020, right? We learned to pivot schedules on the fly as games got postponed, but, we could reschedule games. We proved that we could do that. So we've learned a lot. It's taught us a lot. It's taught us about resilience. It's taught us about, all right, let's remember what's the most important thing is what the phrase I've used thousands of times with our staff, our student athletes, and our parents, Mike, was we're trying to create a path for competition. So I can't guarantee we're going to play a game or not. All we're trying to do is create a path for competition, and we need everybody to be cooperative in that. And it's, it's been for everyone. It's been incredibly challenging. Is one of the things I said in one of our staff meetings. I had great empathy, for working families, right? Where mom and dad are working, you get young kids. They're online. They're not in school, and really try to show real genuine empathy for people that are in those situations. And I think it's forced us to analyze and to think in ways that we never have had to before. There's things that will come out of this that we will continue to implement that we have implemented that will make us better. At the same time, we sure can't wait until we're on the other side of this. And And instead of being in a pandemic, we're in an endemic.
Yeah. Yeah. Last question. And this is just more perspective than anything else. You've had the chance to come back and serve your alma mater. You've done that well. You've had incredible experience. What moves you? What gets you up in the morning in this role? And I'm assuming that there's still joy there for you in the midst of all the craziness. But what makes John Wildhack motivated to get up and get after it every morning at Syracuse?
Yeah, I think what motivates me is all right, what are we here for? We're here to develop young people to their full potential academically and athletically. That motivates me. I've always enjoyed being around young people. When I was at ESPN, I was always available for any young person in the company. I'm available to any student on this campus. If they email me and they want a meeting with me for advice, they get that meeting with me. We're here to serve and develop young people. When we want to reach their full potential academically and athletically, that's what drives me every single day. Obviously, you know, and when you have success, when they have success and you see that joy and that joy in a locker room after a big win, or that joy if it's an, you know, more of an individual competition, a tennis match, a big singles match, when you see the joy of those young men and those young women, that's why we do what we do, Mike. And that's the value of college athletics. And for the critics out there who continually criticize us, they need to understand the impact that college athletics has. They need to understand the attributes that college athletics has. It's the impact it has on hundreds and hundreds of thousands of young men and young women every single year. And it can't be replicated in any other way. And I just, we've got our challenges as an industry. We know that. We've had more change in the past 12, 18 months than we've had in decades. We've got to navigate our way through it. But I will tell you, there's a hell of a lot more good in college athletics than there is bad. And there's no business that's perfect. There's no enterprise that's perfect, believe me. But this one is pretty darn good.
Amen. You know, we've probably done ourselves a disservice over the years of not communicating that part of the message more effectively to our constituent groups. The effect on student athletes' life, one at a time, has been nothing short of phenomenal. So I appreciate you being with me today, John. It's been really great. And thanks for indulging me a little bit to talk a little bit about your ESPN career along the way as well.
Now, Mike, my pleasure. Great to be with you. Proud to call you a friend.
Same here. And I look forward to seeing you live somewhere very soon. So you've been listening From the Chair with Mike Hamilton. My guest today has been the Director of Athletics at Syracuse University, John Wildhack. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.